town, as well as the battery storage facility at the old power plant site. And council felt it was important to help our community really understand how the planning process works. I'm Scott Collins, city manager for Morro Bay, and my background before coming here was in finance, public policy, and public safety. And the planning process was completely mystifying to me. And I've been here for almost 5 years, and I'm still learning. So we realize that we have an advantage in terms of institutional knowledge, but how we develop as a community is much the role of your city, your organization, as it is of the community members. So we really appreciate the city council asking for this meeting tonight. And we're grateful that we're able to record it so people can see it in the future as well. So the presentation goals tonight is really to help explain the planning process as best we can without jargon, so community members understand how that works, as well as figuring out ways that they can engage and learn about projects coming forward. We're not going to talk specifically about some of the projects in the pipeline right now, but we do encourage community members to ask questions tonight. Our goal is to make the presentation about 15 to 20 minutes and then leave at least an hour for question and answer from staff. So with that, I'll turn it over to Scott Graham, our community development director.
Thanks, Scott. I also would like to welcome everybody both here and elsewhere in town to the meeting this evening. Demystifying the planning process, you said it well, Scott. It was mystifying, I guess, for you early on, and so the demystifying part of title of this slide came from Scott. So moving forward here. Okay. So overview of what we're going to talk about tonight, why we plan, the planning documents that are sort of the groundwork for the overall planning process, meaning our land use documents and those types of things. Those are the things that set the table for what happens out there in Morro Bay from a development standpoint. We'll talk about the planning process. We'll talk about the environmental component of the planning process and how we comply with the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. Talk about the role of the Planning Commission, and then the last slide that we have is just how you can gain more information and be more involved in the planning process and what's going on in the city on the development side of things. With that, move on to the first slide. This slide is one that I've probably seen at a handful of conferences. It always kind of makes me laugh, and if you're at a conference that's related to planning and you have a lot of planners in the room, you'll get a few chuckles out of it. And I thought this was funny right up until about 2017, when we started to implement a new project tracking system for our planning applications. And we had to create workflows for our permitting processes. This is a workflow for a conditional use permit. It looks a little more organized, but it still kind of looks like that. And I think this is also part of the reason we're here, is to kind of explain the planning process. It can be very complicated and convoluted, but it doesn't have to be. A lot of times things move forward in a smooth and straightforward manner, but it's not always the case. And then there's always the acronym soup, I'll call it. The jargon that we use that Scott referred to earlier, you see these acronyms all the time in planning-related documents, FAR, floor area ratio, MND, mitigated negative declaration, PC, planning commission, CUP, conditional use permit, and on and on and on and on. So hopefully we'll be able to talk about some of these items and explain what they are and why we follow them and what we do with them. So why plan? I kind of went on the American Planning Association's website today and looked up their definition of planning, and it says planning, also called urban planning or city and regional planning, is a dynamic profession that works to improve the welfare of people and their communities by creating more convenient, equitable, healthful, efficient, and attractive places for present and future generations. Well, that is a pretty good definition. I mean, that's what we strive for. That's like the pinnacle of the, I think, what planning is and what we try to do and what our land use documents try to achieve as well. And I had the picture over on the right. If you look at it, like why plan? And you look at that picture and you see tree wells and there's no trees in it. And you see the sidewalk, and there's trees in the sidewalk. You know, why we need planning is so we don't end up with things like that. A more relevant example, and the picture that you're seeing here is actually in Pismo Beach. I was the planner on this project, so I can make fun of it. What you see there is an entire city block there, and it has sort of high density residential homes there. And there's one holdout, and that just ended up being a holdout. That's the reason it looks that way. But the things you're trying to avoid is really having uses that don't really go together very well, like having single-family houses allowed in high-density residential zones kind of creates odd-looking things and kind of an odd feel for that area. This is just an example I could think of and one that I was familiar with. So. Morro Bay Planning Division, we are located at 955 Shasta Avenue. That's a picture of the front of our building and the front door, for those that don't know. One of our primary objectives, and this is noted on the city's planning webpage, of the Planning Division, is to create, facilitate effective partnerships with the residents and businesses in the community by providing an open and transparent planning process with an emphasis on citizen involvement, participation, and that results in a fair, objective, predictable, and accountable planning process. Again, one of these things we're always striving to do is to engage the public in all of our planning efforts. We've been in large planning efforts almost since the day that I got here. We started updating the general plan early on. That process started in 2016-ish and then ended last year, really in May with the city, and then with the Coastal Commission adopting it in August of last year, our general plan and local coastal land use plan. So we had over 50 public meetings related to that. So that was all about public engagement and in helping shape the future of the city for the next 20 years. So moving on to those important planning documents that I referred to earlier, the top tier one is the general plan. That's the city's blueprint. It sets the vision for the city. What it'll look like, what it'll feel like over the next 20 years. It's a requirement of California government code that we have a general plan. Again, we've just recently updated ours, so it's relevant and current, and ended up being a combination of the general plan and a portion of the item that's below it, the local coastal program. It includes the land use plan piece of that as well. So we combined two documents when we had one before. That makes it actually easier for people to use in the real world, because before it was very difficult to maneuver between the general plan and the LCP. They were sort of mirrored documents, but with slightly different writing in them, so it was very confusing for people to use. The local coastal program, the LCP, it's once certified by the Coastal Commission, it implements the California Coastal Act, and allows us to issue permits as a city on the coast of California. Key Coastal Act priority issues include the protection of coastal resources, public access, recreation, public views, and environmentally sensitive habitat. Those policies related to those are strewn throughout the city's general plan, local coastal land use plan, and throughout its draft zoning code and implementation plan that we're starting adoption hearings on next week with the Planning Commission. Then down there at the bottom, you have specific plans and master plans. Those are plans that cover smaller areas, and they set development standards for specific areas in the city. They allow for greater flexibility, typically in land use, and the applicability of development standards, especially when compared to the general plan, which is meant to cover the entirety of the city. Examples of this would be the North Main specific plan or the waterfront master plan. We are going to be preparing a master plan, and the contract for that master plan was on the council agenda last night for approval for the Vistra Battery Energy Storage System project. We'll be doing a master plan for that, and we'll be having coming up public workshops on that probably within the next couple of months. We're kind of working out timing on that right now. Probably the biggest one planning document, the one most folks are familiar with, is the zoning code. It helps define land uses in the city, identifies where you have commercial and residential and industrial uses located and parks. It also establishes the development standards for those areas. And over to the right there, and I know it's kind of hard to read, is the development standards table that comes out of the draft zoning code that we'll be taking to Planning Commission next week. And you have residential designations across the top, RL, residential low density, RS, residential single family, RM, residential medium, and then RH, residential high density. And then going down the column, you have types of residential development, and it's, you know, single family, multifamily, two unit development, ADUs, and it tells you with a P or nothing that what's permitted in each of those locations. So it's a table that does that. And we have similar tables underneath those zoning classifications that tell you what the development standards are, like for setbacks and height and lot coverage and those types of things. We have other planning documents that are adopted by the city. We have residential design guidelines. When projects come forward, they're reviewed by the planners in conjunction with the residential design guidelines to make sure they comply. We have a downtown and waterfront strategic plan that covers both of those areas. So anytime development is proposed in those locations, we compare them to the development to the policies in those documents, which also have design guidelines in them. They also talk about opportunity areas in there to help out with economic development. And then sort of last but not least, we have the economic development strategic plan that also talks about certain types of developments in given area in certain areas of the city and suggests what would be complementary uses in those areas and encourages certain types of uses in, again, various areas of the city like downtown, waterfront, Quintana, North Main. So the planning process, starts with, do you need a planning permit? And if you do, you're either going to get one or two types of permits from us. You're going to get one that's issued by staff or at director level, so administratively, or you're going to get one that is discretionary and goes, say, to the Planning Commission and potentially City Council and even the Coastal Commission. So an example of that would be all of our development that's along the Embarcadero on the waterfront side. Those all go to Planning Commission, City Council for a conditional use permit, and then they go off to the Coastal Commission to get their coastal development permit because they have original permitting authority along the waterfront. And the picture over on the right-hand side is of the hotel project that's under construction on Tascadero Road over by the high school. So the steps in the planning process, applications are submitted to the planning division where they get routed out to various departments, engineering, public works, fire, harbor for comments. Typically, comments take the form of conditions of approval. The crew to the right in that picture, the two ladies on the left, those are our permit tech and administrative technician. They do most of the permit intake. And so if you come into our front counter, those are the folks that you'll see. And then the two on the right are Gabby and Cindy. And those are two of our planners who will be who process most of the planning applications in the city, along with Nancy Hubbard, one of our other planners who's not pictured in the slide. So once the application is submitted, it gets assigned a planner. The planner has 30 days from the date that application was submitted to review it for completeness. We also require responses from the other departments within 30 days. Again, those responses often take the form of either questions or conditions of approval that will take the form of conditions that are applied to the project in the future when it moves forward for approval. If a project is deemed incomplete, a letter goes out to the applicant. It details the incomplete items. We have a checklist of things that you're supposed to follow when you submit an application, and those are most of the incomplete items are those. And then we also do kind of above and beyond. We do a development standards review, meaning we comply with the requirements of the zoning code and general plan to see if your application is compliant with those items. And the incomplete letter would also detail those inconsistencies, so other items you need to submit. Again, we get the comments from the other departments, and we would forward those along to the applicants as well. And those usually, again, take the form of future conditions of approval. Moving on to steps, step four, if the application is complete, for admin permits, the site is posted. So what you see there, that yellow posting notice is put up on the actual physical project address. You might have seen them driving around town, they're bright yellow, so they stand out. We also mail notices to all property owners within 500 feet of a project. Typically a permit would be issued 10 calendar days later. That 10-day window for noticing allows for folks to provide public comment. Those boards have contact information for the project planner, and input can be provided by the public to those folks, to our planners, to be incorporated into the approval process. The other type of, if a project is complete, like say for a discretionary permit, meaning one going to Planning Commission or potentially City Council as well, we determine a hearing date, and again go through the same noticing processes that we do adding a notice to the paper, but also the posting of the site and the 500-foot postcards that we send out to everybody. Those are also yellow, and sort of idea behind having the yellow postcards and the yellow posting sign is they kind of mirror each other, and so maybe they don't get lost in your mail when you get them, hopefully. I'm going to break out of the planning process piece here for a second and talk about environmental review, specifically compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA. Once a project is deemed complete, the city has 30 days to determine whether the project is exempt from CEQA or if it's going to require additional environmental study, meaning a negative declaration or mitigated negative declaration or environmental impact report. If a neg deck or MND or EIR is required, city staff will solicit proposals from outside consulting firms that do this type of work. Typically, we get two or three proposals for any one document that we're requesting proposals for. We'll sit down with the applicants, we'll work through the scope, what's included in it, and then we'll choose one of the consultants and move forward with the environmental planning piece of the application. That is paid for by the applicant, but is regulated through the city. If it's a negative declaration or a mitigated negative declaration, the city will route through the state clearinghouse for comments. If no comments are provided, the project would move forward to hearing. If we do receive comments through that process, we would either address them in the mitigated negative declaration. Sometimes you can get significant comments that require a significant rewrite. Not very often, but it sometimes happens. And then potentially you would route it back through the clearinghouse again. And so the big one, and for, you know, what you're looking at for probably some of the larger projects in the city currently, the battery project and potentially the 3300 Panorama subdivision, is the EIR process. So the first kind of opportunity from the public standpoint that you get to weigh in is through the notice of preparation. That's a notice that we send out. It also goes to the state clearinghouse. It's a 30-day notice, and while that 30-day notice is underway, we will hold a scoping meeting. We did this for the battery project EIR recently. I think we held two scoping meetings for that, actually, one virtual and one hybrid that was both in-person and virtual, but held in this room. And then so once you do the scoping meeting, we'll take whatever input we get from them, and then the consultant will go back and start preparing all the environmental studies that will go along and inform the EIR, and then they will produce the public draft of the EIR. That public draft will go through a 45-day public comment period. Sometimes during that 45-day comment period, you'll hold that, it says public hearing, it's public meeting, it's not actually a hearing. Sometimes you do that, sometimes you don't. It's an optional item. It just kind of depends on, you know, what's involved in the project and what type of outreach you're doing for it. Because sometimes you're doing outreach that's outside of the environmental process that sort of covers this, sometimes it doesn't. It sort of depends. The consultant will then take all the comments that came in, and they'll respond to those. They'll be responded to in writing, and they'll become a portion of the environmental impact report. And then they will produce the final EIR. If they make any changes in response to comments, or if it just has all the comments responded to, and then that final EIR will go forward to hearings for certification. And once certified, then the project can follow. Sometimes the project follows at the same meeting, or sometimes it happens later on down the road. And see the items over on the right, and you know, like, so what items are we talking about when we're talking about the environmental review analysis that's done? That is not a comprehensive list, but items that we look at are traffic impacts, impacts to biological sources, excuse me, aesthetics, agricultural resources, air quality, cultural resources, geology, soils, things like that. So the role the Planning Commission plays in the review of not just projects, but our land use documents and all those types of things. So general plan and LCP and recently adopted by the city. They assist in the writing of it and reviewing of it. They hold the public hearings for adoption and recommendation to city council. Those same processes are followed for specific plan adoptions and for zoning code amendments and adoptions as well. For project approvals, the Planning Commission will review the projects for consistency with these land use documents that are above. So they will review it for consistency with the zoning, specific plans, the general plan, all the policies within them. Staff provides a staff report that goes along with the processes that goes through review, and it'll identify compliance with the zoning standards, compliance with any specific plan standards or any master plan standards or general plan requirements. So they look at all of those things, and that public process that they hold, those public meetings they hold, are also the opportunity for the public to weigh in and provide comment related to concerns they have for the projects, or if they like the project, express those types of things. That's the opportunity there. And finally, so if you want to learn more about the planning process or more about certain larger projects that are making their way through the city, we have the opportunity for you to sign up for Notify Me. That's on the city's front page of its website. You can sign up for agendas for Planning Commission meetings, for other advisory board meetings, for city council meetings. You can sign up for, we put our larger planning projects up there. So the 3300 Panorama subdivision is in there. The Vistra Battery project is in there. You can sign up specifically for that. So as we add and as we add material to the current planning projects page that has those two projects on it, say we add a biological study, we'll hit notify me, and anybody that signed up for that project will get notified that now there's new material available for you to review if you'd like to. I always encourage folks to do that when they have concerns or are interested in any particular project that's large that we have on that current planning's page. We've done that for a number of larger projects in the city. We also, in the Planning Commission agendas, we have our current and advanced planning processing list. It's in every Planning Commission agenda. You can follow planning projects through the process from submittal through reviews. It'll tell you when an application is incomplete. It'll tell you when it's going to Planning Commission or when it's being approved administratively. It'll tell you if something's been appealed. It'll tell you if something's in the building permit process. Literally, you can kind of follow it all the way through from its initiation at the planning counter to when been constructed. So that's definitely a valuable piece of information if you're interested in planning processes in the city. And then lastly, you can see there's a couple of links there that take you to the community development page where there's additional information as well as to the specific planning page that's underneath that. That's for the planning page, it's www.morobayca.gov/planning. And if you want to go to the community development department page, it's www.morobayca.gov/community-development. And again, that'll take you, and we have a lot of other information related to planning processes and development process on those websites. With that ends my presentation. We're going to open it up for questions. Do you have anything you'd like to add, Scott?
No, I just want to say thanks, Scott, for that. And I did hear a question earlier if Planning Commission was going to be or City Council was going to be here tonight. No, they're not. But they're obviously well aware of this event taking place tonight. We do have a council member in the audience, Council Member Heller, and I know a few are probably watching from home. Typically, or always, they don't get involved in projects before the appropriate time. So as Scott explained, there's a planning process. It's very deliberate. It's governed by state law. Certain things will only get staff reviewed, typically the smaller things like smaller remodels. But as it starts to impact surrounding neighbors or neighborhoods or has bigger scale or scope involved, then it will move its way to the Planning Commission. And ultimately, those things can work their way to City Council, and as Scott said, in some cases, even the Coastal Commission. And so each phase of those projects, our job is to be as objective and as fair as possible. And that's why Planning Commission and City Council won't engage prior to the appropriate time, because they may be seen as creating a bias or some sort of situation to create legal issues should the city deny a permit, for instance, without following that proper process. So that's why they're not here tonight, or why we're not weighing in on projects specifically tonight.
though I know we know there's a lot of questions about some of those projects out in the community. I also want to say the PowerPoint is on the city website under Hot Topics for the public information session, so it will live on the website. So you can, you saw some of the things you weren't able to write down, you'll be able to look at that when you get home tonight or in the future. So with that, I'd love to entertain any questions. I think the mic is working. It wasn't working last night, so we can attempt to do that.
I think we'll take questions first from folks in the audience, and then we'll move on to folks that are on Zoom.
Is this the best approach? Just come on up here.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a number of questions, but I'll just start with three, maybe easy ones. My name is Sean Green, if it matters. The first one is about curb, gutter, and sidewalk. Walking around town, there's a lot of kind of intermittent sections of sidewalk, and some of those unfinished sections seem to have had either partial remodels or whatever. Is there a master map that determines which properties are responsible for completing curb, gutter, and sidewalk? I believe I've seen something where the first two houses in North Main on every block have to do it, but it's a little bit vague. Could you answer like how that is determined?
It is under the purview of the Public Works Department, but I can give you some answers related to it, yes. The North Main specific plan does require those first two houses, as you just said, to have the curb, gutters, and sidewalks wrap around for the first couple of lots there. Otherwise, they're typically required on arterials in the city. So when you have projects that are along those arterials in town, then you will be required to typically put in curb, gutters, and sidewalks. The city Public Works Department does have a deferral process. So as opposed to having one put that in the middle of a block with nothing next to it, they'll allow you to defer that until they get a few of them together, and then they'll require you to put the curb, gutter, and sidewalk in then. So that's kind of how it works and why you see pieces and bits and parts, because I think the city's thought process towards this has changed over time. It's kind of evolved, I would say, and they started doing this process where they would defer them, I want to say like 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, but it was about 5 or 6 years ago, I think.
Okay. Regarding street trees, another sort of public works question. When was the last time the street tree list was updated, and what's the kind of either justification or support for the trees that are listed on that planning document?
I don't know when it was last updated. It was I've been here for 8 years, and it was predates me. Okay. And it wasn't a planning effort at the time. It was Public Works led, my understanding. But that's about the extent of it. I don't exactly remember when it was. There's a date on it, I think. But we can find out, and I can get it back to you. I think Damaris Sanson was involved when it was written. So.
Yeah, I was just curious to what extent droughts were factored in. And then the last question I'll ask, my last public works related question to planning. Once you go through the planning process, at what point does what got approved get a final look from, let's say, planning, so that what is there on the ground is what got approved? You know what I'm saying?
Like that's a great question, Sean. You go through the planning process, and when you're all done with it, you know, you get your planning permits, and then you go off and you get your construction documents put together, and you submit to building, and you get your building permits, then you go build the project. At the end of that process, there's a sign-off, a final, from any department that wants to go out there and review the project. So planning will go out there for any significant project and go out there and do a final review, and they'll check for, is it built the way it's supposed to be? Does it look the way it's supposed to be? Are the decks where they're supposed to be? Is landscaping where it's supposed to be? Is the landscaping the correct amount? Those types of things. To look at the color boards that were approved, does it match the color boards? If there's deviations, we'll look at it and see if those are deviations that can be improved through modifications or minor modification processes, or if there are things that they can't, then that's a problem. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how the process works, though.
Okay. Cool, thank you.
Hi, I'm Ed Griggs. I live on Whidbey Street. And I have two questions. One regards the master plan and zoning. When I was looking through the original, the newest iteration of the master plan, they referred back to the 1980 original master plan in terms of zoning. And what I'd like to know is, do they still refer to that original zoning plan, or has it been updated?
I think what you're referring to is the general plan, the one that was recent, the general plan that we recently updated. And it, I believe it does reference the fact that our current zoning code, the last iteration of it when it was last updated significantly was in 1995. It does date back to the 80s, though. But we are in the process of updating it. We're going through this adoption hearings literally starting next week. And so we'll have a new and updated zoning code, which is a portion of which is also the implementation plan for the Coastal Act. So it will be updated. But it probably does refer to that original document because the general plan refers to all land use documents in the city that were in place when it was written.
So do you anticipate major changes to the original one?
The zoning code was really old and outdated and has been entirely rewritten. I mean, some of the policies are still the same. It's just the entirety format of the document is different. A lot of the policies were changed. It's updated, modernized, cross-referenced, those types of things.
So. The other question that I have for planning, I have it on the best authority that the main sewer line coming from Morro Bay is already at its maximum, and it seems that the issue down on in the Cloisters, because there was an overflow, supports that main sewer line is inadequate now. And are there any plans to replace it?
Yeah, good question, Ed. It's part of the one of the priority projects in the One Water Plan. So the city did a One Water Plan, I think it was approved in 2018, where it looked at water, sewer, and stormwater projects kind of across the entire community, and then tried to select, the most urgent or necessary projects for first phase of implementation. If you tried to redo the entire water and sewer system at one time, it would be cost
prohibitive.
And of course, we couldn't get around town or anything like that. So the water reclamation facility is obviously number one. That was council, put priority on that because of a lot of different reasons, including state requirements to get it done before 2023 or early 2023. But the next set of projects include Main Street, Atascadero Road, Beachcomber. Those areas are known to have some issues. I'm not an engineer, so I'm not going to get into that, but Main Street is definitely identified as one of those priority projects. And we also have some water projects in addition to those that are at the top of the list.
You mentioned the new reclamation plant.
Yeah.
That won't have any impact on the Main Street sewer line, will it?
I don't know how to answer that question other than it allows us to process and meet the federal requirements and state requirements with regard to water quality. We still have issues in our pipeline, so they do need to be replaced. So, they're connected, but it won't reduce some of the issues right away.
That's on the city, correct, to replace that?
Yes.
And any project that comes along that puts a bigger demand on that sewer line, is it conceivable that they would have to pay for it?
Well, there's impact fees that I'll let Scott explain a little bit, but that's a really good question.
That's true. So we do have water and sewer impact fees that are based on the cost to upgrade the facilities. And so when you buy into the system, you have to pay your fair share of the sewer line upgrade, if you will. The hotel project that's on Atascadero Road that's under construction, mm-hmm. they had to do that for the sewer line area that's in front of them, and they had to pay impact fees related to that as an example.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Jeff Heller, quick question. To follow up on Sean Green's question about the final sign-off by the Planning Commission, do you have a checklist of what drawings have to have before they go to the Planning Commission so that they're sufficiently complete, so that you can compare them to the final project? How does that work?
Yeah, so we have a submittal checklist. It's fairly lengthy. It's several pages long. One of the things we're working on is sort of tailoring them to the different applications that we get as opposed to the one size fits all. But it tells you everything you're supposed to. It tells you what's supposed to be on the plans, the scales you're supposed to use, the types of things that we want to see, elevation drawings. It talks about what we're supposed to be on the site plan, whether we need a survey for it, those types of things. It tells you all of those things. And that's really what a completeness review is. It's like, did you comply with all of the submittal requirements on there? We just do a little bit more than that. And during that 30-day period, we also provide you the review of the development standard compliance thing.
So does the Planning Commission have that list of what has to be on there? I mean, there have been some examples where projects come forward and they don't seem complete enough to be reviewed.
I think complete enough to be reviewed is really more along the lines of Planning Commission would like additional information. There's sort of the minimal amount of information that's required. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the Planning Commission feels that they need additional data to make decisions on the project, which is fine. It's under their purview to ask for more information. In fact, the list, the submittal checklist says we can ask for other things, you know, depending on what your project is. It might have some kind of quirky, you know, design or orientation related to it that isn't really covered under the general submittal requirements, and we might need to ask for additional information. That's not uncommon. But if you looked at the submittal requirements, you would see that covers just about everything. It's got everything in the kitchen sink in there, really.
So it's kind of discretionary in terms of what moves forward based on your staff and so forth.
We do the review, and you know, we get it to a point where either it meets all the development standards or that's an issue that we're going to ask the Planning Commission about when we bring the project forward. Say it's compliant with all this stuff, this one not so much, but they wanted to bring forward and make their case to you why you need to approve it that way. I mean, that happens sometimes.
Okay. Could you send that link maybe to the Planning Commissioners just so that they have it as a point of reference? I think that would help as liaison to the Planning Commission. I'm not sure they always are aware of what needs to be on the plan and what isn't. Anyway, that's it for me. Thanks.
I'll do that, Jeff. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Terry Simons from Morro Bay. Follow up on Jeff's comment, and I was listening to the routing sequence that happens as a project transitions from planning to building to final building. In agencies that I've worked with in the past, it's typically been common for once a project meets its discretionary or non-discretionary administrative level, whatever, and the planning documents have been approved, generally when it moves to the building department, you're sometimes looking at the same set of plans, but sometimes you're looking at construction documents that bear hopefully some resemblance to the original planning documents, but not always. And I think that speaks to some of the questions about color boards and these kinds of things. My experience has been that generally before a building permit is issued, not waiting for final approval of the construction project, that planning typically has another look at the planning documents and compares them to the construction documents so that you don't have that unfortunate oops of, if we'd only noticed that your construction documents called for a different orientation, a different building color, a different window type, if we'd have noticed that when you submitted your building plans instead of after you completed your building, save a lot of heartburn. So I wasn't sure that I was following
that's
your description.
That process is exactly the process that we follow.
Okay, I wasn't following you carefully enough when you were describing the process, because it sounded like that once the planning documents were complete, that you didn't look at the construction documents until the end of the process. But that makes a lot of sense.
No, it's a fair point. That is what we do.
A tiny question, big numbers, but tiny question, and not to get too specific to any individual project, but in the context of environmental review and independent preparation of environmental documents, I noticed that when the Vistra's recent environmental documents were first put out, there was a contract let for, and please forgive me, I'm just speaking from memory, $130,000 for the comprehensive environmental documents. And then almost immediately following that, there was a supplemental contract that almost doubled the fees to be paid by the applicant for, I can only assume, a substantially different environmental report than it was originally bid. And then that once that process got started, there was yet another upgrade or contract amendment or whatever. I've been in contracting my whole life, 50 plus years. I understand the process and I understand the dynamics, and it's not at all uncommon to start a project at $100 and then find as you start to get through it that it's maybe going to be $105 or $110. But this one to me seemed especially large in its almost immediate change of order of magnitude. When you have a $130,000 contract and then suddenly it becomes a double that for ostensibly the same environmental review, I just wondered, was there something significant that happened in the public outreach or the scoping meeting or something that suddenly caused this environmental document to be redrafted, or the request for proposal to be so significantly redrafted to where the now contracted consultant was able to come back with such a large change order so early in the process? I don't need the specifics, just kind of what happened.
That's a great question, Terry. Yeah, the project did change substantially. So the original project was the batteries, three buildings, and that was it. And then the project morphed to three buildings, tearing down the stacks and tearing down the main power building, which substantially increased the amount of environmental work on the site.
Okay. So, again, not to nitpick, but having just watched the evolution of our most recent wharf conveyance program, at what point, when you have a significant change in the scope of a request for proposal that's now under contract, do you actually go back and rebid that so that you can get a fresh look at the contractors or consultants that are out there, because you may be dealing with a whole different set of parameters that the originally contracted consultant may or may not have even been qualified to do? I mean, there's a big difference between reviewing a site plan environmental study and a massive demolition project, and it would seem like that if that was what happened, why didn't that go back out for a supplemental request or a secondary request?
In some instances, that's exactly what would happen. In this instance, we were working closely with the Vistar team. They are the consultant for the project on the EIR side of things is Rincon Consultant.
Yeah, I know who
they're quite qualified, and the applicant was very comfortable working with them.
Okay.
So they were just like, we sat down and had a meeting, and they're like, okay. I know, it's full speed ahead with Rincon.
Yeah, they're desperate to fast track their project, and in the scope of their arena, spending $150,000, $350,000, $500,000 to get a $500 million project pushed probably is irrelevant. But I just, like I said, I was trying not to be too specific to the Vistra and more to just the general thinking that goes on when you are putting these kinds of things out for proposal, mm-hmm. that what the strategy is. And clearly in this case, it sounds like you let the person that's paying for it to decide whether they wanted to just roll over or whether you should get it, take another look. But
yeah.
Thank you.
I could definitely see scenarios like opposite of that, though, where we do go back out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the scenario.
And unfortunately, sometimes that doesn't happen when it should.
Yeah, fair point. Rigmore.
Hi, my name is Rigmore. I have a quick question. When they do the final review on a project, do they also look to see, like, if the project had dug on another people's property because they need to put down foundation, will they fill back the dirt in, what do you call it, a ditch? Like, they had to put down a foundation, so they had to dig a long ditch, very deep. Do the inspector take a look to see if they complete that or fill dirt in, or does someone have to go and talk to them?
Yeah, it would normally be on the plans, and there would normally be an agreement between the two parties that would allow somebody doing development to grade off their site. So we would normally have those documents in place as well, and so we would follow back up on that to make sure that it did get filled back in, because it would all be part of the project. I mean, if it was something that happened, they graded off site, and they didn't have permission for that, they'd be stopped, and they'd have to go get that permission or come to some resolution about how they would resolve it, because you're not supposed to work on other people's properties without the permission.
But they can get that permission from the tenant, right? So, because...
From the owner, not from the tenant, from an owner.
So if they never got it from the owner or the tenant, then we have to, or someone has to look that it gets filled back, I guess.
Yeah, we would be working with the property owner that didn't provide authorization to figure out what they wanted done to resolve the issue. We'd be working with both parties to try to resolve it amicably if we could, but
yeah. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Kristen Hedlund. I live in North Morro Bay. So I have a couple questions. So if we have a project that gets completely approved, there's for a multi-residential area, is there going to be a form that someone is responsible for tracking the review of every step along the way, like for the soil, then the foundation, and then the parts of building the house and the height of the building? And will that form be made public so that the citizens know where the process is with the project?
What you're talking about is the building permit process.
Mm-hmm.
And or the grading for the subdivision. I mean, that's mm-hmm. also inspected by the city. Both Public Works and Building do inspections on the grading. We'll usually have special inspectors that are out there that'll prepare reports, and we can make those available. As far as height and setbacks, we do height and setback certifications. We get those for every project. And so those are in the project files for the building division. We can make those available upon request. So that information we do have, and we do make sure that they're following the requirements. And it's not just, when I say certifications, they're done by surveyors.
Mm-hmm.
So not just somebody with a tape measure.
So here in the city of Morro Bay, there's only so many water permits that get passed out per year. So how does the city decide who should get them?
We do that through the water allocation process for the water equivalency units. And that's approved by city council. And we just recently approved it back in June.
Correct. So if you have you only have 50 water meters that you're going to pass out per year, how do you decide who? Is it first come, first serve on the permits?
Normally it is, yes.
Okay. And so if you have a development that's already gone through the planning process and you get a permit, and if there's any changes to be made on that, how do will the public get notified?
Well, minor modifications can be approved at the staff level. Major modifications are required to go back to Planning Commission. It's a regular hearing process, so notices would go out like any other project, 500-foot. You know, radius notices and those types of things.
So the minor modifications doesn't require the public being notified?
The process doesn't. We often do, unless it's like to the location of a window or something simple.
Yeah, something simple, but yeah. Something major.
Yeah, and staff, it's in a little bit of the gray area, right? Because the code doesn't require it. We just do it as a courtesy if we think it's something the neighborhood might be interested in, or it was something that was commented on maybe during the review process.
Mm-hmm.
Then if it was something along those lines but still could be approved administratively, we would notice for it, yeah.
Yeah. So, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but, okay, so if you have someone who comes before you and they want to build to the max of what's allowed, you just allow them to? Or because that's what they want to propose, and then it goes through the planning process, and and the planning commissioners make a decision whether they like it or not, and then you get public input as to whether there should be any modifications to that?
So we have the development standards, basically the zoning code, right, that I was speaking about earlier, and it has the development standards in it. And that sets the setbacks and the lot coverage and the floor area ratios and all the height and all those types of things. And so that's the box you can build within. And then so an applicant will come forward with something that fits inside the box, hopefully.
Right.
Not always the case, but normally that's the case. And then we have design guidelines that go along with it. So if it's like a residential use or unit, we compare it to the design guidelines, and we're like, okay, fits within the box, meets the design guidelines. If it's an administrative permit, it's probably good to go. But we still do noticing, so the neighbors get to know about it and they can weigh in. If it's, you know, planning commission, then it's all noticed and it goes to planning commission, and they do the design review on it.
How about, can you explain the setbacks from ESHAs?
The setback, we have various buffers depending on the type of ESHA. It can be 50 feet, it can be 100 feet. Environmentally sensitive habitat. it depends on the type of ESHA, though. And it can be, like, if it was from a creek, you know, you set the ESHA starting at the creek bank, and then it's a setback from there that goes back 50 feet or 100 feet, depending on the type of ESHA, again, that it is.
Okay. So, yeah. Well, how many different kinds of ESHAs are there?
There are several.
There are?
I don't have the general plan in front of me, but there are several.
It can be found on the website.
Yeah, the general plan, the general plan, local coastal land use plan, does have the ESHAs mapped that we know about.
Yes.
And then it requires us, if we identify other types of ESHA, it still counts. Like if we do a biological report and it comes up like, oh, this is one of those things that we're supposed to protect, it can become ESHA that's not mapped.
Okay. Well, that's it for me. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm Catherine Belt. I live on Whidbey Way in Morro Bay. I have a few questions. Number one, how can we find out the status of a project? Let's say I'm looking, I won't name the project right now, but I want to know where we are. Is there a site on the website that I can go to and it will say we've approve this, this is still under consideration, you need to go here for that? Something simple, because I'm having a hard time following.
So it's a good question. Good question, Catherine. We have two opportunities for you. You know the address of the application. We do post the current projects list with every planning commission meeting. It's within the agenda. And you can follow any project all the way through, and it'll tell you where it is in the process. For larger projects, we have a current planning page, and you can go on there. So a larger project would be the Panorama site or the Vista Battery Project site. And we post all of the information, you know, related to those projects, like the environmental documents that we get as they come in to those locations. And we have the Notify Me thing you can sign up for on the front page of the city's website. And you can, for large projects, you can sign up specifically for those. And then you would get notified every time we update that page, that portion of the page for that project, you would be notified.
So where would I go to on the internet to find that?
Front page of the city's website, Notify Me.
I did that.
You click on that, and one of the options in the list of things that you can sign up for, some of them are city council agendas, planning commission agendas,
yeah.
But there are actual project things you can sign up for on there, and you can sign up for the battery project there, and you can sign up for the 3300 Panorama.
And I did do that, but I'm wondering if I can go on there, and it will say, okay, here's where we're at. Now we still have to do this.
So it's, again, it would be two pieces. It's the current planning tracking list that's in the planning commission agendas. That gives you the up-to-date status in a linear fashion of where the project is, meaning it's under review, the application's incomplete, although we post the incomplete letters on the project page as well. So if you looked at that, you would see that the application's incomplete and nothing's changed. But so they kind of mirror one another, if you will. I mean, the page, the information is submitted there.
What could make a development zoning change allowed other than a request by the developer? Is there ever a time when, after approving a particular project, it's decided this is not going to work? We need to go back to square one and make changes.
I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at. You said, can you repeat that?
Let's say a development is approved for 1,000 lots, and the Planning Commission, City Council, community members get together and say, this just is not going to work. Is there a way to go back to square one and begin the process?
Once they receive their entitlements, and assuming it's with a vesting tentative map, not really.
So you can't change it.
I mean, unless there is some, you know, something we find later that's, you know, is such that you can't construct the project there. There are serious soil stability issues or something that they can't engineer around or something. I don't know. It would be something like that. It'd have to be something major, though.
Okay. On the environmental impact items, let's say infrastructure. And the infrastructure as it is not going to work. Before the project can continue, does the developer have to pay for the necessary changes to the infrastructure?
Certainly, it depends on what the deficiency is related to infrastructure. You know, I mean, if it was traffic control, like say there was so much traffic going through an intersection that was uncontrolled, that it triggered the need for a stop sign. They could be required to put a stop sign in. If it's related to a project and there's an impact fee related to the improvement of the infrastructure, water lines, sewer lines, or whatever, they would pay into that. If the line was at capacity where they were at, one of the solutions that they could come up with would be to install the line themselves, because otherwise they would have to wait until the city installed the line if there was actually no capacity for them to connect.
So anything on infrastructure, the developer needs to pay to make a project continue?
Well pay fair share. You know, sometimes it's just that. They pay impact fees, which is your fair share of that improvement, whatever it is. If it's an upgrade of a sewer line like we were talking about on Main, then you would pay your fair share of that amount. And assuming the line's not at capacity, you could connect to it. And then it would be upgraded at some point in the future.
Do surrounding community members carry any weight in decisions about developments?
So the public input process is, I think, a significant portion of projects as they come forward. I think what happens, a lot of times there's significant changes that are made to projects based on input that come from the community. Some developers don't, I imagine, don't care, but most listen to the community and at least try to make some changes to address concerns that they're able to address. You know, sometimes the developer's not super familiar with the neighborhood, they don't know what's going on there necessarily, and as you bring things forward, they go, we need to go look at that. And if the city's aware of it as well, we'll talk with them and work through issues. And so you oftentimes see changes to projects resulting from concerns raised by the local neighborhood. An example, it's right up by you, is when the tanks were being demolished, there was concerns about the streets and the sewer laterals, and we had the applicant indemnify the city for and the folks that lived along those streets for any damage that was done to the sewer laterals.
Assuming the same thing would happen if the sewer lines were hurt by this current development coming through.
Potentially, yeah.
One last question, and I'll quit nagging you. Do you contact the California Coastal Commission regarding ESHA items, or do you call them and say, hey, you need to come and look at this and tell us what we need to do regarding this, or do you just follow specific rules?
No, we have very specific rules in the city's general plan, local coastal land use plan, and implementation plan that tell us what to do with ESHA. If we have questions about what we're supposed to do in certain circumstances, then we'll make contact with the Coastal Commission. We talk with them on any large project. We talk with them regularly, early and often, about the projects and the issues that we're seeing, and you know, do they have concerns about things and that type of stuff. I mean, it's an ongoing conversation, and we speak with them regularly.
Okay, thank you.
Betty Winholtz, you talked earlier about noticing projects within 500 feet when something's going on. When you have a project like the zoning ordinance that affects the whole town, should all of us have been noticed and received a postcard?
No, we're not required to send out notices to everybody when it covers large areas of the town, like over 1,000 notices. We do that through the paper.
Okay.
And then we put the notices also on the city's website and through social media, typically.
Okay. So you would put them on the city's website, you put it in the public notices in the newspaper, mm-hmm. and those are the two main ways.
Correct.
Okay.
Sean, if you don't mind, if there's nobody else that's here that wants to comment, I'd like to go first to the folks that are on Zoom because they've been waiting.
Sure.
And then we'll come back to you, okay?
Sure.
All right. AGP, do we have anybody on Zoom that would like to speak?
Thank you. We have no raised hands in the queue.
All right, Sean, you're up.
My first question in this round is, are there any, so it seems like there's an understandable, I don't know if disconnect's the right word, but there are members of the public that may want to chime in on a project kind of proactively to encourage an improved project for the entire city, but yet there's a hesitance on the city's side to have that happen from a city standpoint because council or planning commission or whoever can't be inherently biased by that proactive effort. Are there any efforts from a city standpoint to encourage applicants of large-scale projects or applicants of potentially contentious projects to voluntarily reach out to the public, like maybe has been done recently once or twice?
We constantly do that. Yeah, whenever we know that there's a project of interest, we ask the applicant, and I'll go back to the two that we've been talking about, or at least I've been talking about this evening, Panorama Project, we asked and really requested and strongly that the applicants for the 3300 Panorama Project conduct a neighborhood outreach meeting. Because we knew there was a lot of concern up there. There was a lot of concern with the tank demo project, and they did that. Might not have been the most comfortable meeting that I've ever been to, but I think, you know, they heard loud and clear that there was significant issues. I think that was really valuable. And so I think that proved worthwhile, and I think it's going to prove worthwhile in the changes to the design designs that they're making. Same thing for the Vista project. We've been working with them on conducting outreach at multiple venues, chamber events, they've come to city council meetings, planning commission meetings, they've, Rotary, I think they've presented at, and
tours.
Oh, they did a tour with the Story Bay News as well, yeah, sorry.
Have they ever made what might be even less contentious and more productive, has anyone ever made an email address available to the general public just to offer some more productive or more positive forward-thinking thoughts rather than more contentious back and forth? I've never seen that.
So, Sean, are you saying for a specific project or just in general?
In general, if a developer who's probably pretty well aware that their project may be contentious or pretty impactful on the city simply makes an email address available to the general public, it may actually appease the public in a way that provides them feedback. They can come with a project that's less contentious. I know this isn't really a forum for suggestions, but kind of my question was.
No, I mean, well taken. That's an interesting concept. I'll give that some thought. I mean, I kind of like it. Mm-hmm. I think it might be better on the side of the city to do it, and then we can forward, you know, the commentary, you know, that's to the applicant. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I kind of like that.
A very very small example that might lead into a bigger question. A few years ago, my house was listed for sale, and a buyer went into planning and asked about a 9-foot 10-inch driveway. And was thankfully, in hindsight, told that no future development could happen on the back side because it wasn't the full 10 feet width. I think it might be an intern or something. Could you explain the terms exceptions, variances, and modifications to city standards in a way that's simple enough that we can see what's possible?
Okay, so variances, I'll start with variances because those are founded in state law. And variances are really something that you have to have some unique circumstance to your lot that doesn't apply to the ones around it, such that you can't develop equal to what others could, you know, if you apply the same development standards. The example, you know, might be that everybody has a rectangularly shaped lot and you have a pie-shaped lot. where's your front setback, where's your side setback, and then you try to apply the setback standards and you can't really build a house on it like the other folks around you, you might ask for a setback exception to one of the side setbacks or the front, depending on where your pie's facing. And you might, where say five is required, you might request a variance for three to give you a house that's maybe similar in size, you know, to the ones that are around you. So that might be an example for that. Exceptions, we have, you know, policies in the, we have various policies in the zoning code that allow for deviations from development standards, depending on, you know, where you're located in town, what slopes you have on your lot. Like in some areas on the hillsides in town, if you have a fairly steeply sloped lot, you can have a garage that's at 5 foot setback from the street. So there are exceptions like that that are built into the code. And what was the other item that you asked?
Modifications of city standards for people that may be required to provide additional public benefit, for example.
So those, I mean, that's you know, so the good example of that is along the waterfront. Typically, you're allowed to build single story down there. If you want to build two story, you have to provide extra public benefit, meaning you have requirements down there for setbacks and view corridors and public access along the water, right, for the boardwalk, the, you know, or the harbor walk. And if you want it, you have to provide extra things if you want to get to that second story height, which would be to 25 feet. And so that might take the form of a wider harbor walk. Maybe you go from the required 10 to 15. It might add, might be adding public bathrooms. You see public bathrooms on a lot of the sites down there, although there's one of the larger points of contention. But the, things like that get offered up as extra public benefit and to obtain the, you know, the two-story buildings oftentimes.
Okay. And my my last question is, what is the planning department's relationship with code enforcement, and what kind of what falls under their purview or that interaction? And is there any way for the public to access specific addresses of deemed non-compliant properties, whether it's from a planning or a construction or even a vacation rental standpoint?
So so code enforcement is housed under the Community Development Department, so me, reports to me. We're small staff. You know, so we have planners, we have one code enforcement officer right now. We're getting ready to hire a code enforcement slash building inspector coming up here pretty quick. But the planners, the code enforcement, you know, person and building, they work together, you know, closely on who's going to take something. Like sometimes we get a complaint about something, and if it's in the building realm, perhaps our building inspector, Chad Omet, is out there and he can go talk to them. If he doesn't have time, then maybe Jason DeForest, our code enforcement officer, will go over there and find out what's going on, to see what this, you know, what the scoop is and see if there's what the issue potentially is. So code enforcement is usually done by Jason, can be done by the building inspector, and even can be done by planners, just kind of depending on what the issue that presents itself is. But normally it's Jason.
All right, thank you.
If I don't ask it now, I'll forget. Sorry. Listening to Sean, I heard a word that was relatively new in my planning vocabulary. I attended a planning commission meeting a couple of months ago, and there was significant discussion in the process of denying a project about whether the project provided sufficient public benefit. I tried to find any codification of the concept of public benefit in the zoning ordinance, and until I heard you speak tonight about the Embarcadero, where is public benefit as a codified portion of either the zoning or the general plan or the local coastal plan?
So it does apply in the waterfront master plan, which is an adopted portion of the city's zoning code, and it does apply to the plan development overlay and policy that is in the current zoning code.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because when I looked up, tried to follow that through the city's website, I found that there had been a recent submission by your office to the planning department or planning commission, wherein you were discussing the general concept of public benefit, and there were some specific projects, the Vistra project and a couple of other waterfront projects, and that the limit of that seemed to be a single presentation to first to a select subcommittee, which oddly enough Sean is on, and then a general presentation to the Planning Commission as a whole, but I couldn't find any recorded actions taken by the Planning Commission, and I certainly couldn't find any referral to the City Council to codify the recommendations that your office was making regarding implied public or required public benefit. Can you help me find that?
So the process hasn't played out entirely right now. We have the subcommittee on the Planning Commission is now reaching out to other advisory boards to get some input from them related to that, and that's happening real time, like right now.
Okay.
So we'll come back at some point at a future meeting to see if we can get any sort of recommendation from a majority of the Planning Commission that we would be able to take to City Council.
So would it be fair to say that the denial of a project by anybody, whether it would be the Planning Commission or the City Council, based solely on lack of public benefit, except in the waterfront zone where that's been codified, would not be consistent with current ordinance?
With the exception of something that's that has a plan development overlay on it, if they were asking for exceptions there, the plan development overlay talks about providing public benefit to get that. Okay. Usually, like for a residential subdivision, that might be extra parkland or something, but we do have that in...
The particular project that I've been tracking is just a small single-family residence, and it happens to be on a bluff.
Yeah.
And it has in its original iteration, it had a couple of minor setback variations. And then when I happened to be at the Planning Commission meeting where that was heard, and I spoke to other aspects of the development on that property, but when I heard the Planning Commission basically say, well, we don't have a problem with anything on this project except that its lack of public benefit, that started me down that track, and I could not find how that particular parcel was required to provide public benefit. But then I don't quite understand what constitutes public benefit anyway, so more to be discussed later. Thank you.
Sure.
When we were working on the unnamed project that is not to be discussed here, we found that the city website was inadequate in terms of the documents that we could review so we could understand the project better. Specifically, I called the State Water Quality Control Board because there was some releases regarding that particular project, and they have there's a state website where you can access any state generated document. And I asked them if I could find that, and they started looking around. They couldn't find it, and it turns out it was misfiled. But the point is, that document should have been in the public record. And so my question is, does the updated general plan specify what sort of information is required? And if not, will the planning department learn from what happened in the past and make sure that everything related to that project gets posted? I mean, in terms of official documents, that's one question. So can you help me with that?
So yeah, Ed, we do our best to post all the documents that the tank demo project is what you're talking about, I believe. We did our best to keep that the website up to date with the documents. And every time we found one that we hadn't put up or would notify that there was something that was available to us, we would make sure we posted it. You know, there's a lot of work that went involved then. There was a lot of paperwork that was associated with that project. So we were doing the best that we could. That's about what all I can say to that. There's not a requirement in the general plan that requires us to post the information.
Mm-hmm.
It was just us trying to be responsive to the neighborhood. We were trying to give you everything that you guys wanted or that we had. And we weren't trying to hide anything from you. I mean, we were doing the again best we could to post the information. So.
Okay, thank you. That's one. How does the Planning Commission, the Planning Department go about, just in general, how they choose between an EIR, a mitigated declaration of, a mitigated declaration, or just a regular, regular declaration?
Yeah. Be as straightforward as I can. If a project doesn't fall within one of the categorical exemptions in CEQA, then we're left to do an initial study, which evaluates potential impacts to a project and will let us know, like, is there any impacts that can be mitigated on a project? And you might do a mitigated neg deck, or maybe you do that evaluation of the initial study and there's no impacts, and you don't have to do any mitigation. That would be a neg deck. If there is mitigation, then there would be a mitigated neg deck potentially. And if there's something that you can't mitigate, you might be doing an EIR at that point. Or for larger projects, you might want to do the EIR anyway because you do a fuller evaluation and you do an alternatives analysis, which is oftentimes what people are interested in from the public standpoint. So a more robust review of environmental documents. Sometimes it's the same as an MND, but you do the alternatives analysis as well, and it gives you a better picture of what the possibilities are.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jeff Heller again. I'd like to follow up on that. The different classifications for CEQA in terms of impact, are they made by the consultant that the city hires, or is an iterative discussion between the consultant and city staff? Is there a checklist on what is a neg deck and what requires mitigation? What's that process like?
It's why we mostly now don't do in-house environmental work. We contract it out. The CEQA process has become so convoluted and complicated that we just don't have the time to do it in-house. So when we find ourselves in a situation where we need to do one of those documents, an ND, MND, or EIR, we'll go out and have a consultant verify that we need to do those things. And we'll have those conversations going back and forth because sometimes it can be either one. It just kind of depends. And it also depends on, what is the project really controversial? Maybe there's no need to do a statement of overriding consideration for anything, but it's just going to be very controversial. So you might want to do an EIR or a focused EIR on a very specific impact that maybe comes out of the public review process or the public comment process that's associated with the project. They're concerned about one very specific thing, and you can do a focused EIR on one specific issue or a couple issues, or you can do a full-blown one. It just depends on what the impacts are and whether you're looking really at things that you can't mitigate fully to less than significant, then you're definitely going the EIR route because the city would be required to adopt statements of overriding consideration to allow the project to move forward.
Okay, it's obviously a complicated process, and it's changed over the years. Hasn't there been a lot of litigation for and against it?
It has, and it's largely the reason we've transitioned, out of writing environmental documents. That we just don't have the staff that can be dedicated, like one person to write environmental documents. Like the county, they have several planners, and they have several planners that write environmental documents. They do it themselves. Most of the cities in the county don't write environmental documents. Before I came here and I worked in Pismo Beach, I used to write most of the MNDs that we had. I wrote most of them. When I came here, I stopped that, and we've only written a couple of them since I've been here, and kind of stopped doing it several years ago just because of the time involved.
Okay. We talked early on about ways that the community can have input in response to projects. Can you kind of list what those might be for a typical project? Let me just give you an example. Let's say there's a house that's being built and it's in full compliance with the setbacks, the height restriction, it meets the design guidelines, and that's all done by staff. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go to Planning Commission, is that right?
Correct. Well, okay. For the most part, unless you're in a coastal appeal area, okay, or something, or it's, you know, you're adding onto a non-conforming structure. But,
okay.
But yeah, it would. So if you're just saying an admin permit, the first time the public gets noticed of it is when we send the notice out.
Okay.
So we notice the postcard, 500-foot radius.
Right.
Poster on the front, you know, front lawn that says, "Hey, we got a project coming here, bright yellow," and then then that comment period starts.
Okay, so if they want to see the plans of someone within that 500-foot radius, they can look at it. Can they provide comment on whether or not they think it complies with the design guidelines for?
Yes, the area. And they can provide comment to us on anything. And sometimes, you know, we get things that are raised that weren't initially thought about or what have you, and we'll go back to the applicant and say, "Hey, you really do kind of have an issue here. Do you want to address it? You're maybe looking at an appeal. You know, do you want to go through that when there's something that is fairly simple that you could do to change the project?" I mean, we do interact quite a bit when there are concerns that are raised, especially, you know, really valid concerns and things that we see like, "Oh, that might be an issue. We could see if you made this minor change, then you might be better off, or everybody might be better off, and we might not have to go the appeal route to Planning Commission, City Council."
Okay. Let's see. To Catherine's point, she talked about, and I know you have the spreadsheet about applications and the status of them, but it'll say incomplete or whatever. And I think maybe what she's looking for is some kind of a checklist that the community could look at and say, okay, these things are required, and this is what's been done so far. And I don't know if that's your point or not, but, and I don't think we have that, but I think that's a good idea if there's some way to do something like that.
There's not a simple way to do it. I mean, we do the completeness reviews, and we do have the letters. We just, you know, the incomplete letters that we send out, so you can know that something's complete and what is said there. I mean, it really is, like, if you're interested, if you pay attention to that current projects list, you can see any project that's going through the city. You don't have to, like, attend Planning Commission meetings or anything. Yeah. And listen to what's going on. You can just look at that, and you can see everything that's going through the entire process. So if there was something of interest that's next to you, you could simply, you know, inquire with the city, and we could provide you any amount of information that you wanted on it, because all of it, you know, for the most part, is public information.
So in those documents that are listed, is there a checklist that you use internally to see the progress of the project that is posted there or not?
Well, the checklist is the submittal checklist, and all the stuff that's supposed to be submitted, anybody can look at that. That's posted online. But there's not a, like, we don't check off, like, "Oh, it's complete now," other than on the tracking log. The tracking mm-hmm. log says, "Oh, this application's complete. Oh, this application is scheduled for Planning Commission hearing at this date. Oh, this we've sent the notice out on this application." I mean, that's when it gets updated.
So, if for the communities, I mean, a lot of people love projects, but usually people get involved because they don't like them. So, so in terms of what a person could do, if you're within that 500-foot radius, they could pull up the plans and look at the plans and say, "I don't like this. I don't think it meets the design guidelines." And then what? Send an email or comment to you about it? Or
yeah, they could okay. email me. They could email the project planner on it, and the project planner will take a look at it. We meet internally every week on the planning side of things, and we go over anything we got comments on. We'll usually sit down and go over what those comments are. We'll look at the plans. You know, a lot of times when we get comments, depending on what they are based on, the planners will go out to the site and look at, say, is this really happening, or is this somebody that's maybe just having a portion of their view blocked and they don't like the project because of that. Okay. That happens a lot, and we don't protect private views, so that's a common theme that they'll look for issues with the project when maybe a view
right.
is being blocked or something.
Right,
so.
Okay. Back to CEQA again. So the best way for the community to get involved is when that draft, that notice of preparation comes out, right? And you have things to choose from the list.
It's really good to get involved then, and when we do this for an EIR, or when we do the scoping meeting, we have a public meeting in here. You can come to that. That's great. You can provide written comment anytime during the scoping meeting process. And then we're going to release a draft EIR. So if you missed the scoping meeting, you didn't really miss an opportunity, because that comes up and you can provide comment on it all again. And it all has to be responded to in the final EIR, like in writing. You know, whether this is an issue or whether it's not, did we make a change related to the comment that you made? Did we not? Why didn't we do it? Because it was covered in this environmental study that says it wasn't an issue or what have you. I mean, that's normally what happens.
And then if there's a disagreement between, say, community members on an impact, whether it's avoidable or unavoidable, how does that get resolved?
Well, I mean, they bring forward their comments. We hired a professional consultant to tell us whether it's okay. Sometimes we'll see, is there things that we can do if it's on the edge of something like, hey, can we change the project in some way to address that? If we can't, and the project's compliant, and there's no issue, then we just simply state that in the EIR and move forward, and then they would be making those comments through the discretionary process at Planning Commission and City Council.
Okay. Back to public benefits. I know I'm jumping around a little bit, but public benefits apparently don't apply to any areas except those with the PD overlay and the master waterfront. Is that true?
Correct.
So if I'm building something out of those kinds of areas and I say, well, I want to change the setback here and I'll throw in some public benefit, that's not part of the process. Is that right?
No.
Okay. And then what if the public disagrees with the public benefit that's presented by the developer as not being sufficient with the accommodation that the city has made with development standards?
How does that get resolved?
That never happens.
No. So, I mean, it gets resolved typically through the discretionary process, again, at the Planning Commission hearings and City Council hearings. I mean, we will, you know, when we get those comments ahead of time, we'll sit down, we give it to the developer, and we're like, hey, you know, what do you think? You know, and they get to make the determination whether they think it's adequate or not. If we think there's things they might want to make a change to because we think the Planning Commission or City Council might have an issue with it, we do that. We spend a lot of time interacting with the applicants based on commentary that we receive from the public because we take it seriously. And we want the project to be as good as it can be. And when valid things come forward that are potential issues, we want to resolve them. We don't want to walk into the Planning Commission and it's like, sorry, we don't know what's going on with this project. It's a mess. Here you go.
Right.
We're usually trying to resolve as many of those issues as we can before it, you know, lands in their lap or it lands in the City Council's lap.
Okay. And a question that was asked earlier, what's the difference between an exception, modification, a variance? I don't understand that still.
Well, modifications.
Are they interchangeable?
Yeah, modifications in the code are really just related to the. I didn't really address this, you know, straightforwardly. I think are really just related in relation to the approval process. So when something goes through and gets approved, we can do modifications to the project either at staff level for small changes, or if it requires a major modification, that goes back to the Planning Commission if it was a discretionary permit to begin with. That process internally, we review it and figure out where it's at. I would say just about any change that's made to a project that touches on an issue that was raised by the Planning Commission during, you know, their comments,
mm-hmm,
is always going to be major. Because staff, I mean, I my practice is we don't make changes to things the Planning Commission directed. that's not my job. They wanted it. They voted for it. If you want to change it, you have to go back. But other than that, minor changes, again, like I said, the example was window placements or things like that. Or I don't want to have this bush here, I want to have it over here, whatever. As long as it wasn't part of the commentary from Planning Commission, small stuff like that can be approved at minor modifications.
Okay.
At the staff level.
Those are my questions. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
This will be the last question. You got it, Terry.
Oh, okay. Well, I better make it a good one then. When I go to the store to buy a t-shirt, I'm generally presented with some options, small, medium, and large. There's been a lot of discussion this evening about small projects versus large projects. But as near as I've been able to discern over the years of watching projects go through, the nexus of what constitutes a large project, for instance, a $500 million energy project, and a $50,000 small residential remodel. It seems reasonable that the required budgets or the required process or the required mitigations for a $500 million project, there seems a reasonable nexus that spending $250,000 for an EIR seems reasonable. The converse of that being when you have a $50,000 remodel, in state law or local ordinance, is there any methodology that's been codified that says, no, we're not going to mitigate a $50,000 project with $500,000 worth of mitigation? Is that codified in state or local law or anything like that? Or is that simply the luck of the draw if you pull a very small project and suddenly find yourself where the project has been driven to economic infeasibility because of implied mitigations or environmental impact studies or engineering reports or these kinds of things. Does your office have a methodology for looking at that and go, whoa, wait a minute, this would be unreasonable. It would lack foundation in just basic common sense to make a small project economically unviable by surcharging it with so many process requirements. Am I making sense?
I understand where you're going with it. It doesn't really, I mean, I'll be honest, it doesn't really ever come up. So it's not something I think about very much.
Good.
I mean, projects are usually right-sized. You know, I mean, when we're doing the environmental studies for projects, you know, they're usually on the level of a couple thousand dollars, maybe if you're in an archaeologically sensitive area, or you're right next to Esha. They're usually in that range.
Okay.
And they usually don't make your project infeasible. They usually just provide parameters that where you have to redesign it maybe or move it around to stay a certain distance away from it or those types of things. And so you don't usually run into the infeasibility issue when it happens. Not normally, anyway.
Okay. Well, yeah, I've got a couple of different projects, not necessarily in this jurisdiction, that the application of planning overlays and other things like that have created additional requirements that appear to create a taking, if you will, because they so invalidate the underlying property, and particularly when those overlays and other requirements were added significantly after the property was originally acquired. And I just wondered if you knew of any state law or court decisions or anything that tried to address that.
I'm not aware of anything, Gary. Okay. I mean,
well, lucky you.
You run into anything, let me know.
I will, believe me.
Well, thank you, everyone, for the excellent questions. I think we had about 30, 40 questions, or all really insightful, both from a detailed level to a general idea of how the planning process works. I sat here looking at Scott, not because I wanted to avoid the audience, but because I'm learning. Every time I sit down with him, I learn about the process. Hope you all learn something, too. And we are very available to the public, both Scott and I, and all of our staff and council and planning commissioners. So anybody has any additional questions, don't hesitate to reach out. We have the information on our website how to reach us. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, everybody. Appreciate all the great questions. Sometimes. Sometimes. That was a great question.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could be much more relaxed. We don't have like folks sitting up there.
Smile once in a while. It's not bad.